This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. As the show Parks and Recreation was coming to a close, Aziz Ansari, one of the show's stars, and Alan Yang, one of its writers, began working on a new comedy series. It's called Master of None and is now available on Netflix. Master of None stars Ansari as an actor trying to make it. But in addition to the obstacles typically faced by actors, his options are further limited by the fact that he's Indian-American. The series revolves around some of the same issues Ansari and Yang have faced. They're both first-generation Americans. Ansari's parents are from India. Yang's parents are from Taiwan. Before we hear Terry's interview with Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang, let's listen to a scene from Master of None. Here, Ansari's character, Dev, is in a restaurant talking with his friend Ravi, who is also an Indian-American actor trying to find good roles. Dev is complaining that some of the Indian characters on TV and in movies actually are played by white people, including a character in the 1988 film Short Circuit 2. Ravi, who is played by Ravi Patel, speaks first.
What's wrong with Short Circuit 2?
They got a white guy to play an Indian guy?
With the robot movie? With Johnny Five?
Wait, you don't know this?
Wait, which Indian guy are you talking about?
Dude, that guy's a white guy.
The robot or the Indian?
The Indian guy is a white guy. That's Fisher Stevens. They use brown face makeup.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they got a real robot and a fake Indian.
I'm sorry, man. Wow, I'm experiencing a lot of emotions right now. Man, that's like one of my favorite Indian actors.
Dude, it still happens. You see The Social Network? Max Minghella plays an Indian guy. He's white. They browned him up.
No, I read that he's 1/16th Indian.
Who cares? If you go back far enough, we're all 1/16th something. I'm probably 1/16th black. You think they're going to let me play Blade?
Aziz Ansari, Alan Yang, welcome to Fresh Air. Aziz, is that clip an example of why you wanted to start your own series? Because there aren't enough good parts for Indian-American actors?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And also, I don't think a white guy would have written that scene. I think that topic is something that makes our show special, that Alan and I have a perspective to write an episode like Indians on TV. And also, another reason I wanted to do the show is not just as an Indian actor, there's frustrations. I think just as an actor, there's frustrations when you don't create your own content. I feel like if I didn't do this show, the kind of stuff I would have been offered, if it wasn't just ethnic stuff, it would have been just versions of things I've done in the past. So it would be lesser versions of, like, the character I did on Parks and Rec or in Funny People, where I would just come into a room and yell things. And that sounded vaguely like treat yourself. And I really wanted to do a show that was like Master of None, that really had my comedic viewpoint the way my stand-up has or the way the book I did has. And I think we pulled it off.
Alan, as a writer who's Asian American, do you face any of the limitations that actors do in terms of what roles they get? Because as a writer, you're in the writer's room, like you're not visible, so people aren't going to see your face and say, I'm white, I don't identify with him because he's Asian American. You know what I'm saying? Does it matter if you're a writer?
You know, early on in my career, I didn't think about it that much. I'll be totally honest. I think as a younger writer, I always wanted to do stories that were universal and really I didn't want to be seen as an Asian writer so much. But as I've gotten older, the more I've thought about it, I don't think I've ever worked with another Asian writer in a writer's room. And I've worked on several shows for over a decade now. And I think that's interesting. And I think as I matured and as I created the show with Aziz, you know, we're both minorities, and that became part of the show. And it became a sort of thing where the personal, you know, our experiences as not being white people becomes universal just because it's so specific. So, you know, as we got older, I think we became more comfortable with sort of writing more about race.
So one of the plot points in one of the episodes is that if you're an actor, if you're an Indian American actor, there's only one Indian American per TV show. There can't be two. So you're always up against a friend of yours for the same roles, and it's really awkward. Has that happened to you in real life?
That same exact situation hasn't happened to me, but I do know some Indian American actors who have relayed stories of auditioning for shows and basically saying, well, they already got their Indian guy. They already filled their quota, so they're not going to cast me as well. And then me and Alan, the writers, started talking about this, about whether they would ever cast two. Like, what would happen if two guys were really good? Like, if they're doing a show with three people, like, what would they do if two of the best guys were both Indian guys? Would they cast them both? And that conversation, where we never really figured out what the answer is, became the germ of the idea for the episode.
And another thing about that, your character refuses to do an Indian accent. And I mean, this is true even if it's the role of a cab driver who's an immigrant from India. So why would you, like, decline to do an Indian accent even if you're doing a character who is actually recently arrived in America?
Well, to be clear, I don't think doing that accent is totally wrong. I think that's a personal choice that an actor has to make, whether they want to do that. For me personally, anytime I've been asked to do that, I feel like it feels like it's making fun of people that have that accent if I do it and don't have that voice. I don't know why I feel that way. It just doesn't feel right to me, and it feels like you're doing it so white people can laugh at Indian people. It feels kind of mean to me in some ways. And it depends on the script or something. If it's like an intense drama about an Indian cab driver and it's this deep, passionate story and you have to do an accent, okay, then it's like, all right, well, I maybe would do it for that if it's something like that. But if it's the guy sitting in a cab and it's me saying something in an accent, making a joke about curry spilling on my pants, I don't see the merits in that one.
So there's a great episode about two of the main characters in the series. Aziz, your character, Dev, and then another character named Brian, who's Asian American. And they both don't know a lot about their parents. Their parents are both immigrants who came to the United States. Brian's parents are from Taiwan. Dev's parents are from India. And neither of them really know much about their parents' backstory, but they often don't have time for their parents. You know, like Dev's father wants to show him how to do something on his iPad with the calendar, and Dev just doesn't have time for that. And Brian's father wants him to show him something, and Brian wants to get to the movie early enough so he could see the trivia contest that's on screen before the movie starts, because it's, like, really important. So they decide, you know what, we never get a chance to say thank you to our parents for all the sacrifices they've made, you know, to, you know, come to America and bring us up in, you know, in the United States so we could have good lives. So they decide to take their parents out to dinner. They go to an Asian restaurant, and this is where the stories start coming out that they've never heard before about their parents' lives. Are each of you first generation?
Yes. I think it's very accurate in the show. Our parents are both immigrants from those countries.
Those are our real parents' stories for the most part. There's slight changes we made, but in the beginning of the episode, there's a flashback of both of the dads showing their journey coming from India or Taiwan to America and all the, you know, struggles they went through. And it's based on our real dads.
That episode, right. That episode, the germ of that episode actually started when I remember I was sitting in Aziz's hotel room and we were trying to work on the show. And I told him this story about my dad, which was real, which is that he grew up in a 500 square foot hut in Taiwan with a single mother and two brothers, and he didn't have enough food to eat to the point where he had to kill his pet chicken when he was 8 years old or something to eat it for dinner. And I was talking to Aziz and said, and now his son gets to sit in a hotel room with a famous comedian and work on a TV show with him. And it was just so staggering. And Aziz had similar stories about the sacrifices his family had made. And it's just something you kind of take for granted sometimes as the children of immigrants. And it's very legitimate. All of the emotions in that episode are very real because I've felt that guilt before, and I think Aziz has too.
Yeah, and I think it's not just pointing the fingers at the kids too. It's also pointing the fingers a little bit at the parents and saying, hey, maybe like talk to your kids and reveal a little bit of yourself and open up a little bit every now and then. Because I think both our families didn't share those stories, and we kind of had to push it out of them. And we really wouldn't have pushed as hard as we did unless we needed it for the episodes.
There's a very real thing where I think I did bond with my dad a lot more because I was researching the episode. So I had a lot more phone calls with him than I had previously. So it was almost life imitating art there.
Has your dad gotten mad that he didn't get to play himself and that my dad did?
I haven't told him about that yet. I think
he doesn't know that?
I think he knows, but I don't think he wanted to act, unlike your dad.
My dad was very eager. He's ready to find his next project.
Yeah, I think Michael Bay, if you need an older Indian man in the next Transformers, Shahrukh Ansari is available.
My dad does accents. He'll do anything.
But he has an accent.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. He'll do an American accent.
So Alan, did your father also have a water buffalo in Taiwan?
No, that was actually, this is really interesting. The guy who plays Brian on the show is named Kelvin Yu, and Kelvin is also a Taiwanese-American comedy writer. We found the only other one to play the Brian character. And his dad, he had the same stories. Kelvin and I both grew up in California, and I think his dad did have a water buffalo.
He did.
So that was, I believe, an improv from Kelvin.
Yeah, because we were doing that scene, and I was rehearsing the scene with Kelvin, and he's like, well, I can say my dad had a water buffalo named Ting Ting. And I was like, wait a second, you can't say that. That's not real. And he's like, no, he had a water buffalo. And then I was like, you have to make 100% sure your dad had a water buffalo. You can't say that if you're not 1,000% sure, because it'll sound crazy if he didn't. And then he texts his dad, and he's like, okay, he had a water buffalo, but it wasn't named Ting Ting. It was something else that wasn't quite as funny as Ting Ting. I was like, all right, just say Ting Ting. It's fine.
We can let that slide. By the way, it sounds like Kelvin's family was better off than my dad's. They had a water buffalo.
They were rolling.
Yeah.
They had so many water buffaloes.
That's the equivalent of a Lexus.
So, you know, for a lot of people, they could visit their parents' like old neighborhood, which might be in the same city or in another state. But like, Alan, you're never going to be able to go to like the hut that your father grew up in Taiwan. I'm sure that hut doesn't even exist anymore. But, you know, it's just so that distance is so great. It must be really difficult for you to imagine what your father's life was like.
That's absolutely true. And it's funny you should say that. The one time I visited Taiwan, I was 7 years old, and I actually did visit that hut. And
really?
It's in a town, a small village called Tiger Tail. And my dad's mom stayed there for the rest of her life. And it was really interesting because when my dad was born, he was the youngest of three sons, and his father passed away when he was 1 year old. And the people in the village told his mom to give him away because it was just too much. It was a single mom with three kids. And his mom worked in a factory making the burlap sacks for rice, so she wasn't exactly rolling in money. But she decided to keep my dad, and my dad ended up being a really smart, hardworking kid, and he would go help her at the factory. And it's all sort of test-taking based in Taiwan. So he took a standardized test in high school and did really well, and he was able to go to a straight medical school program. So he ended up being really successful. He came to America, moved to New York, then moved to California. And even after all that, he thought about bringing his mother over to America, but it was just too drastic a change. So she stayed in Taiwan. And there is a psychic gulf that exists between myself and my grandparents because they don't really speak English and I don't speak Chinese. And that's my own personal shame because I did not learn ever. But I only saw my paternal grandma a few times in my life, and that's really crazy. I think, yeah, all these white people visit their grandparents all the time, and I think there's a bit in the show about Aziz talking to his grandparents. It's the same thing with mine. If I'm talking on the phone to my grandma, she doesn't speak English, and I don't speak Chinese, so I'm not sure what we're supposed to say.
There's this kind of strange conversation of obligation that you have that is really a gesture that doesn't mean anything, and I do it in the episode. There's an episode called Old People that's about grandparents and not about grandparents but about respecting the elderly and getting to know old people a little bit and not just ignoring them. And in that scene I tell my girlfriend about how when I talk to my grandma we just have the same conversation where I go like, hello, how are you, okay, I can put my dad on now. And me and my brother just do that every time. Like every couple of months, my dad will be like, you should speak to Amar real quick. And I'll be like, okay. I'll just run through that. And then we're good.
Yeah, you could play a recording. It sounds really familiar. That's what I do with my grandma.
Aziz, what did you learn about your parents from trying to get their stories out so you could put them in your series?
I basically learned the stories that ended up being in that second episode. My mom told me, it's like it's described in the episode where she says that she got here the first day. But in my mom's case, it was South Carolina. In the show, the character is in New York. But in my mom, she came to South Carolina. My dad picked her up from the airport, took her home, and then my dad had to go to the hospital and work. And so she's sitting in this apartment in South Carolina. She doesn't know anyone. She's all alone. She had an arranged marriage, so she'd known my dad for about a week, which is true. It's in the episode as well. She met my dad. A week later, they got married, and then she's in America. And she's just there in this apartment. I asked her, like, what did you do that first day? Like, did you watch TV? Did you, like, read a book? And I put it in the episode because it hit me so hard. She just said, no, I just sat on the couch and cried. And you hear that and you're like, wow, these people really did something pretty incredible to get here and give me this spectacular life that I've been able to have. And I've never really thought about it. I never thought about them coming to South Carolina and trying to build a life in this strange place where they didn't know anybody and dealing with racism and like much harder racism than like, oh, I got to do an accent in the audition, like real stuff where people are pretty mean. So it was a great conversation to have. And I think a lot of immigrant kids probably don't have that conversation with their parents because it is kind of odd. Even if you're not an immigrant, to be like, Mom, Dad, tell me your story. Like, let's talk about that. It just feels kind of odd to bring that up. And I think it's one of those things where kids are like, oh, I'll ask them at some point. And then I bet a lot of times they don't end up doing it and they never get to learn these stories.
Well, I'm wondering if you found that there was a big difference between, like, friends, the parents of your white friends and your own parents in terms of how they demonstrated affection or encouragement or how they talked about themselves.
Well, that's in the show too.
Yeah. I mean, there's a line in the show that is exactly that, which is from my own personal experience, which is, I had a white girlfriend and I met her parents and they hugged me. They hugged me more times over the course of that first dinner than my parents have hugged me my entire life, basically. But that's just cultural. You know, that's not anything. That's not my parents' fault. It's just a cultural thing where affection is a little bit less expected between family members. And I love hugging my parents, but it's very American to do, so I force them to do it.
But how old did you have to be before you realized, oh, it's cultural? I shouldn't be, like, angry with my parents. It's not, like, their fault.
How old were you, Alan? 33?
Yeah, I think it was last week after I saw the episode. It fairly old. I think a lot of these things you just internalize and you take for granted, you think it's normal, and then as you get old, you get some perspective. And frankly, I was never angry at my parents. My parents have been unbelievably supportive and open-minded. I mean, my parents have been very open-minded because I pursued this crazy career in comedy, which is a job that I didn't even know existed as a kid, and I'm sure blew their minds as people who came to America from a different country. Suddenly their son is going to try to write jokes for a living? That's insane.
No, when you grow up in a hut, there's no way that you're thinking your son is going to be a comedy writer.
I think my son will be an executive producer when he grows up.
Just to add to what Alan said, I think my parents were unbelievable parents, and I don't really fault them for not sharing more of their stories growing up or whatever. And I think as I've gotten older and matured, all of us, me and my parents, have gotten better at expressing ourselves and building a stronger relationship.
Aziz, your parents play your parents in the series. And why did you cast your parents? Strikes me, it's working out great in terms of my perspective as a viewer. It strikes me it could have the potential to be very awkward.
Well, Alan and I had those characters of my parents, and we knew the character of my dad was going to pop up in a few episodes. And he was based on my real dad, the way we wrote the character. And my real dad is very funny and silly. And for me, it was very important that we got these characters right, because a lot of times when you see immigrant parents on television or film, they're portrayed in this unbelievably broad fashion, and they're just vehicles for very hacky ethnic jokes that are not real. So we wanted these characters to feel three-dimensional and real. And we auditioned a few people for these parts of my parents, and when they read, they just didn't feel like my parents. They didn't feel, it felt like people doing impressions of Indian people, and they just didn't have the timing and humor that my real parents had. I think my mom's funny too, and they just didn't feel right. And those parts are really important for that second episode, which maybe the best episode of the series. I think it's one of my favorites. Those parent characters have to be really good, and if you don't buy those characters, the episode doesn't work at all. So we were at this position, and we didn't know what to do. And I told Alan, I said, "Hey, this is maybe a crazy idea, but I said, do you think my dad could do it?" And Alan was like, "Well, let's have him come in and audition and see how it goes." And so he came in, my dad came in, and he, like Alan said, he'd always wanted to act for some reason. Like whenever we were doing parks, he would pull Alan aside. He would meet Alan just socially and would pull Alan aside and just be like, "Is there any way you could maybe write some sort of role for me on parks?" And, like, say this seriously.
How awkward is that?
I loved it. I tried to get him in. It almost happened, actually, but we didn't quite get there.
Yeah, it was close, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So he was down, and then he auditioned, and he was pretty good. He felt more real than the other guys, and it was one of those things where Alan and I thought, well, if we get him on set, he'll become more comfortable, and he'll eventually be able to do it. And it happened like that, and it was great because it was interesting. When he first came on set, he was very nervous about memorizing his lines and everything, and by the end, he was really way more comfortable. He was improvising and giving us notes on the scripts and stuff. It was pretty great. And then my mom was the total opposite, very shy, does not want to do it. And I really had to, I really pretty much said, like, you have to do this for me. And she was like, "This is a very strange favor you're asking of me." I'm like, "Please do it." So they both agreed to do it. And it's really strange because usually when people have their real parents do things, it's a pretty quick cameo type situation or like one scene. They were in it a lot, and you know, they it wasn't like they came into town for a couple of days. They were here for like 2 weeks working on the show, and my dad took off work from being a gastroenterologist to do an arc on my show. It's a pretty crazy thing he did, and I really have to thank them tremendously because I think their work is great, and it's so crazy to read reviews where it's like Shaukat Ansari comes in and steals the scene, which is, of course, not going to go to my dad's head at all.
By the way, there was an ironic moment where in the episode Indians on TV, the character of Dev is put off by the fact that the people are asking him to do an Indian accent. And we started auditioning people to play Dev's parents in the show, and we were making them do Indian accents, and some of them didn't have strong Indian accents to begin with. So we were basically doing what the producers in that episode were doing, so we felt bad. I mean,
yeah,
we wanted to get someone who had a real accent.
Yeah, and it felt like whenever they did the accent in the audition, it felt like they were making fun of my dad. It felt weird. And, you know, we were asking them to do an accent, but it was one of those things where I justified it in saying, well, the joke isn't that he has an accent. It's a right. character that's a three-dimensional person. So it's just being accurate to who he is. So it's like when Daniel Day-Lewis changes his voice.
It's basically exactly Daniel Day-Lewis. He came in on red. He was great. But
Daniel Day-Lewis was going to play my dad, but he didn't feel as real as my real dad.
So, Aziz, your parents had an arranged marriage. They knew each other a week before they got married. And you do a lot of comedy about dating and romance. You have a book that you co-wrote with a sociologist called Modern Romance. It must be really hard when in your mind you compare your parents' marriage with your idea of what a relationship should be.
Yes, I think it's such a vast difference in the way that whole process is for me today than it was for my parents back then. And we talk about that in the episode. Whenever I'm having the conversation with my dad, I think it's in episode 10, and I'm asking him, like, how many women did he meet before he decided to marry my mom? That's the real story. He told me that he met two people. My mom was the second person, and the first lady, he thought she was a little bit too tall. Then he met my mom, and I was like, well, how long did you talk to her before you decided to get married? And he said, like, 30 minutes. And then he was good. And then you look at me and Alan, if we have, like, a lunch menu, we will spend 30 minutes trying to figure out what the best dish is before we pull the trigger on an order.
And then we'll decide to get them both and split them.
Yeah.
Was the end of Parks and Rec emotional for you both?
Absolutely.
Sure. That was such a tight, close-knit group of people, and I think there's been countless interviews where we've all talked about how close we are, and it's true. And it was really an emotional day, that last day on set. But I do think creatively I was ready to move on to something else, as was Alan. I think personally it's rough not to get to see those people all the time. They're such a great group of people. But creatively I was really excited to work on a new project.
Yeah, that was just such an incredible job and an incredible group of people. And, you know, I think both of us sort of grew up on that show. You know, we started in our mid-20s on that show, and you know, going into that writer's room, I think those seasons of Parks were written by some of the greatest writers I've ever worked with, for sure, and that staff was really great. And on a show like that, where you're doing 22, 24, or 30 episodes a year even, as a writer, you're in the writer's room so much. It really is. I was eating 15 meals a week at work, and that really becomes your family, and it was really fun. I also learned a lot on that show, so I'll always have, you know, it'll always be really, really special to me. I loved working on that show.
Alan, well, my last question for you is, you used to work on South Park as a writer, and there's a couple of moments in the new series, Master of None, where somebody does a Cartman imitation. Has that followed you wherever you go?
That was, yeah, I did pitch that, I think, for that character, just because we were coming up with ways that she could be sort of unlikable. And obviously, everyone knows South Park is a genius show. It's just kind of a dated impression. But that stuck, the reason that stuck with me was, you know, I was only at South Park for a brief time, but I do remember just starting out there, and you would have to pitch jokes. And Trey Parker and Matt Stone would pitch the jokes in the characters' voices. So it was really unfair because Trey would just do it as Cartman. And there's no way that I, as a 24-year-old kid or whatever, trying to outpitch him or whatever. But anyway, it always stuck with me, that sort of embarrassment of me kind of doing a Cartman to pitch jokes, but not really. And so I was like, man, what if this character really thought she was really funny doing a Cartman and just aggressively doing it over and over again. So, yeah, that experience did come in handy.
So, Alan, did your father, who grew up in Taiwan, watch South Park?
I think he might have checked out a few episodes. It was actually really cute because my mom teaches high school in Riverside, California, where I grew up. And she – actually, Moreno Valley, which is right by there, but she lived in Riverside. And – you know, South Park was the first thing where I think it's – when I worked there, I think it seemed like I actually had a real job, because it was really adorable. She said she was visiting Germany, and she emailed me excitedly and said, Alan, South Park is on in Germany. She couldn't believe it. And later she cut out a newspaper clipping that was review of South Park in the San Bernardino Sun, which is a local newspaper, because she I don't think she realized that South Park was a big show, so she was cutting out local newspaper clipping reviews, and her students at her school really liked the show, so I think that was the first time where it seemed like her son actually had a real job and shouldn't go to law school.
Alan Yang and Aziz Ansari co-created the new Netflix series Master of None. The entire first season is now available on Netflix. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with actress Ileana Douglas. She's written a new memoir titled, I Blame Dennis Hopper. What does Douglas blame Dennis Hopper for? She tells you in the first chapter. When Douglas was a child and her father saw the 1969 film Easy Rider, starring Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda as hippies on a motorcycle journey through parts of America, her father decided to transform himself. He wanted to be Dennis Hopper, not the actor, but the character he played in the film. Soon, her father became a hippie and started a commune, and, as we'll hear, this had a big impact on Ileana's childhood and on the rest of her life. Douglas got her start in film working with Martin Scorsese in Bit Parts, then in Cape Fear, in which her character was brutally raped by Robert De Niro's character. Ileana Douglas and Scorsese were a couple for several years. Her movies include To Die For, Grace of My Heart, Picture Perfect, and Ghost World. She had recurring roles on The Larry Sanders Show and 6 Feet Under, and co-starred in Action, the Fox sitcom satirizing Hollywood. Her paternal grandfather, Melvin Douglas, was an Oscar-winning actor.
Ileana Douglas, welcome to Fresh Air. Since Dennis Hopper and Easy Rider really did change your life in a major way, let's talk about that.
Sure.
After your father saw the film, what were the first ways you noticed him changing and becoming more Dennis Hopper, Easy Rider-ish?
Well, first of all, the movie Easy Rider in 1969, obviously it changed a lot of people's lives. As I later said to Dennis Hopper, you know, I feel like in some ways, all of us that grew up in that era are all children of Dennis Hopper. And Easy Rider depicted, you know, the rise of the hippie culture and also wanting to change your life. And I think that a lot of people felt that way. And so my parents made this life change. You know, the first thing that happened was he started to grow his hair longer. He started to grow a mustache. I mean, he started to resemble Dennis Hopper. He started to.
And his sentences with man a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the first things were, you know, getting the Steppenwolf album, listening to it again and again, that same song.
Born to be Wild. You know,
Born to be Wild. And then, as I say in my book, you know, what's interesting was that, you know, there was no hippie handbook. And so my father actually, I'm not quite sure where he found the hippies, but the first hippie he found, Tom the Hippie, looked exactly like Dennis Hopper, too. He had the fringe jacket. So I think that, they were emulating. That's why I say that, you know, movies can change your life. They not only were emulating looking like Dennis Hopper, because I think, again, part of the movie, the message of the movie, remember, long hairs. And so in order to identify yourself as a hippie, you had to have the hippie getup.
So your father decided to start a commune. And what's confusing to me is that you didn't all move into the commune. The commune was like near your house, but it wasn't your house. So would you explain the relationship of the commune to your home and where exactly your father was living?
Yes. What's interesting about this is that when I say to people, did you grow up on a commune? And I didn't grow up on a commune. There was a commune. My father had a commune and called the studio. And, you know, we, as I said, we could visit it. It was on our property, but it was a commune. There were hippies living there and, you know, gardens and animals and things like that. But it was specifically on our property. And then we lived in the big house. Looking so down.
How much
on
property
the studio.
Did you have? Were you in the suburbs and there was a commune in the middle of your suburban lawn? I'm trying to get a picture of this.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, 7 or 8 acres of wooded land. And this was near the pond. And it was a pretty idyllic commune, I have to say, as communes go.
So did your parents stay together through this?
They stayed together, yes. Although they lived separately and eventually. I think the lifestyle just was probably a little bit too much on my mom, and they split up.
So you went on to study acting, and you mm-hmm. got your break in a really hilarious way. You were working for a well-known publicist who had major clients, and the office was in the Brill Building, where a lot of songwriters and movie people worked. Scorsese had his office there, and Martin Scorsese was making The Last Temptation of Christ. And he needed to add some screams in post-production. His assistant knew you were an aspiring actress and asked if you could scream. Would you describe your audition for screaming for Martin Scorsese?
Well, just to back it up ever so slightly, the joke, of course, was that I had actually sent, because I had done a play in school and the director told me I had a great blood-curdling scream, I had put it on my resume under special skills, great legs, and blood-curdling screams. And, you know, I figured one would get me somewhere. But I put it as a joke because I didn't have any credits. And I thought, well, someday this will make people laugh. Then the next thing, I actually had heard about Last Temptation of Christ. and sent a postcard with my head wrapped in a turban to the casting director. Funny, that never made it to Martin Scorsese. And then there I am working for Peggy Siegel, and I get this call from Marty's assistant saying, you know, I'm looking here at your resume, and do you really have a blood-curdling scream? And I'm saying, oh, yeah. And we're having this conspiratorial discussion because I'm at work. I mean, I'm not supposed to be moonlighting. And so she said, well, if you really have the scream, go down there at, you know, 5 o'clock and you know, scream for Marty. So I went down there and, you know, they were making fun of me, like, you know, let's hear it. And I kept saying, you know, it's really loud. You got to really back up. And they were just thought the whole thing was a joke. And the more they were making fun of me, I said, I'm going to scream them right out of the building. And so I did, you know, I said, just give me a minute. And I did like about 10 jumping jacks. And then I let loose with my horrible blood-curdling scream. And there was complete silence and then applause. And then Marty said, my God, that's horrible. How do you do that? And I said, well, I work for Peggy Siegel. It's pretty easy. You know, a big laugh at my boss's expense, a colorful reputation. And then it became this progressive, like, that was good. Can you do Jesus's mother? And I was like, yeah, sure. Literally, I had no idea like what I was doing, but because it was Martin Scorsese, I was like, I'll just keep going down as long as they want me. And then I got the big, like, you're going to replace somebody's part because he liked my voice.
So let's hear you screaming in The Last Temptation of Christ. And of course, this is the Martin Scorsese, Paul Schrader version of the Christ story with Willem Dafoe as Christ. And I think Harvey Keitel as Judas.
Yes.
So, and this is like the fall of Jerusalem. And
that's it. That's me.
And the screaming tape loop in the background is you, right?
You betcha.
Okay. So bring on the screams. This is Ileana Douglas okay. screaming. It goes on.
Oh yes.
How many of those
yes.
screams were yours? Are we hearing your like a multi-track version of your screams, or are those a lot of people screaming?
I'm not sure. I know. I believe I did all the screams. I mean, I'm all over the movie. I work cheap, meaning I worked for no money because they just kept saying, "Can you do this?" I was like, "Sure." I'm in show business. I'll do whatever you want, you know. So I did everything. So I don't know how much of it, you know, since it was literally my first experience in show business. I'm not sure what they ended up putting in there, but.
So this led not only to more screaming, but it led to other parts with Martin Scorsese.
Yes.
And another famous. Well, more famous thing that you did was the scene in Cape Fear where this was Martin Scorsese's remake of Cape Fear, where Robert De Niro as Max Cady picks you up at a bar and mm-hmm. and you're about to have sex and you're like, you've been drinking, you're like laughing hysterically, his shirt is off, he's got like tattoos all over him. He's a really scary looking character because he really is a scary character in the movie. Mm-hmm. And he takes out his handcuffs and starts handcuffing you, and you're joking like, oh, am I under arrest, police officer? Because you think this is all just a joke. And then he handcuffs you, and then he pulls your hair and starts really hurting you, and you're screaming. And then he takes a bite out of your cheek. I mean, a huge bite of flesh out of your cheek, and you're like bleeding and screaming. It's just a horrible scene. What was your experience of that scene with Robert De Niro?
Well, the first thing I had to do was take Robert De Niro out of the equation because I had seen people, you know, I was on the set of Goodfellas, I mean, almost every day, just observing. I was always a great observer. And it was one of the privileges of, you know, being with Marty was just getting to sit, you know, slightly, always behind him. No, never next to him. No, I'm kidding. But to observe how people would fall apart working with Robert De Niro, because, you know, it's like you're on a tightrope with this amazing actor and you suddenly wonder how the heck you got there. And it can be very unnerving. And so the most important thing for me was to fall back on my training. I did something called an emotional preparation, which is not my strong suit, which is meaning you really, you know, you get into the head of this character. And my emotional preparation was two things. One, I knew that I was going to go home, you know, with Robert De Niro and have like this great one night stand. You can't think about the danger. And my experience being kind of a wild kid was that, you know, you never know you are in danger until 2 seconds before something happens. And then also falling back on my knowledge of films and Hitchcock movies, that's what makes them so exciting, is that the audience is saying, oh my God, doesn't she see that this guy is a monster and, you know, he's going to kill her. So I stayed in character. That first day of the rape scene was 17 hours. And I was like, you know, Stephen Boyd in Ben-Hur after, you know, I remember, you know, Bob jumped off the bed and said to Marty, I think she's done. And it was like, you know, I said, it was like Stephen Boyd. They just, you know, took me in a stretcher. I literally couldn't move. You know, I would have died, you know, for my art. And it was quite painful.
So you became a couple with Martin Scorsese in addition to being in several of his films. Among the things you bonded over was a love of film and comedy. You could quote lines at each other from films and Mel Brooks albums. But honestly, what were some of the ups and downs of being a young newcomer actress with a revered director as your partner?
Well, you just said it. I mean, that's the, you know, I always could not, you know, comprehend what Marty saw in me, you know, but we were very, and as of course, as I got older, I did, but, you know, I didn't quite see it. And so obviously I was trying to retain who I was, which going back to my roots, I really feel, you know, again, I was this rebel, I was this hippie kid, and had a lot of, you know, ethics and wanting to make it my own way. And, you know, Marty was a very successful director. I must say, at that point, coming off of Last Temptation of Christ, he was not the revered director that he is now. So much of our experience of courting through Goodfellas was infusing the movie with the new romance, you know. So both of us were very much in love and shooting people and enjoying killing people. No, it sounded so odd, but that was everything I wanted in a partner. I wanted a part, you know, I really did want that kind of John Cassavetes, Gina Rowlands relationship. That's what I was looking for. And I had it with him. The only problem for me was, oh, but he's so much more famous than I am. So for me, being insecure, yes, that was always an issue.
So did your relationship with Scorsese end because you wanted more independence?
No. It ended, as I think that many artists' relationships end when they should end, but I didn't know that at the time. You know, I learned so much from being with Marty, but I think that in some ways there was, you know, a Pygmalion kind of a undercurrent to our relationship. And so although I was not the one to initiate the breakup, all these years later and all these many experiences that I've had later in different relationships, I can see that the relationship ended, you know, when it needed to end. And that, as an artist, you see the future. And I think he saw that I needed to break free and go out on my own and have my own set of circumstances and films. And that's what, you know, that's what art is. That's why it's, that's why it means so much to me.
We started this interview by talking about how your whole family life was turned upside down after Easy Rider was released in 1969, because your parents saw it and your father decided he was going to become a hippie and start a commune and be like Dennis Hopper. You ended up working with Dennis Hopper in 1995 in the film Search and Destroy. And you not only work with him, you your character sleeps with his character in the film. What was his reaction when you finally were able to tell him the story of how Easy Rider and his character, his portrayal in Easy Rider, changed your whole family's life?
Well, you know, it's interesting because at first he was very sheepish about it and kind of made jokes and, you know, sorry, you know, and we'd make, you know, we'd make a lot of jokes about how we ruined all these kids' lives and everything. But as we got to know each other on the film, I don't say this word lightly, he was a mystic. He really was. He was in touch with so many things. And, you know, we talked a lot about acting and he just was on another plane. And I really did appreciate him. And one of the tragedies, I think, in Dennis Hopper dying relatively young is that he was not, you know, given the proper attention that he should be in the lexicon of American filmmaking, I think. I did get to tell him that a few times later, his gravitas and what effect it had on me. And I did tell him that I was writing this story. And I think that he really appreciated that. And I'm thank God I got to tell him. Thank God. Because that's what's gotten me through this whole experience of writing the book, feeling as if I had his permission to write it, which was extremely important for me.
Ileana Douglas is the author of the new memoir titled I Blame Dennis Hopper. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farragut. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inkooly.
Exploded to space. I like smoking lightning.